You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras, the number one podcast for bow hunting product information and hunting stories from across the nation. And now, here's your nine-fingered host, Dan Johnson.
Alrighty, everybody, welcome back to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras. I tell you what, I was pretty excited today because I was actually recording this podcast hours ago, and as I'm wrapping up, I glance up at my wall full of shed antlers that I found over the years, and I notice a characteristic that was similar to the buck that I ended up shooting this year. So what do? I take about 10, 15 antlers off the wall and start looking at them and just like finding things that match the deer that I shot this year. And I end up finding a match set from as a two-year-old, a right side as a three-year-old, and I already knew I had his right side as a four-year-old. So I actually have four antlers, one of them being a matching set, from this buck. And I can tell you exactly where I found them. They were in a cornfield, the same cornfield or ag field, because it rotates, the same ag field that I found his four-year-old shed. And we're talking 100-some yards from where I ended up killing him at, or shooting him at. And that's awesome. I don't know about you guys, but I love shed hunting, and it just like extends my whitetail season throughout the entire year. So the season, once the season's over, you wait however many months to get out there in March and start looking for these antlers. And it's cool to put the pieces of the puzzle together and have several years of history with this deer. And it's pretty cool finding something new every day. I knew I had one shed guaranteed, but as I start digging through my pile, I realize that, hey, I have three additional sheds from him, and the characteristics are pretty much the same. And you can kind of see the progress of how he went from just an eight and then transformed into this nine, this magnificent nine pointer that I ended up shooting as a five-year-old. So, that right there makes me happy. So there's that. Now, today's podcast, we're going to be talking with a gentleman named Rick Henley, and the reason we're talking with him, because he is one of the co-chairs for the Iowa chapter of the BHA, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And I went to a pint night recently, and I said, hey man, let me get you on the show, and you can share with everybody what steps Iowa is taking in order to become an official chapter of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, because we currently don't have a chapter. And I think that's important, especially for a state like Iowa, where public land is a rarity. There's not a lot of public land compared to some of the western states or any eastern state, really. So that's what we talk about. We kind of talk about why he became a chair, why he wanted to be involved with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. We talk about the pint nights that we've had, membership, and then the official letter outlining the membership that we have to submit to the national organization with three state issues that we plan on addressing. So it's a pretty cool story about how this chapter has grown and hopes to become an official chapter by December this year when they have their national meeting. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Now, before we get into today's podcast, I want to share a quick story about one of our sponsors, and that is Wasp Broadheads. Now, I jumped up my arrow weight this year, and I stuck with a fixed blade. And I am very, very positive that when I say this, I'm confident when I say that if I was shooting a mechanical broadhead, I probably would have not recovered my deer. I think I would have lost a lot of momentum in my arrow. And I think the combination with a heavy arrow and the Boss four blade broadhead that I was using allowed me to get superior penetration into this deer, mess him up really bad, and eventually getting to the point where I could find him. I just don't think a mechanical broadhead would have been bad in a marginal shot. And you hear a lot of people say, dude, I shoot a mechanical for marginal shots because they leave a bigger cutting diameter. But in a scenario where this buck was hard quartering away and I hit hind quarter and went into the guts and went into the liver and exited out the brisket, it was just one of those things where I don't think I would have got the penetration if I was shooting a mechanical. And after a scenario like this, I was thinking, does a mechanical broadhead really mean that it is is a mechanical broadhead really going to do better in a marginal shot? And although Wasp offers mechanical broadheads as well, because some people love mechanicals, I myself am a huge fan of these smaller diameter, fixed blade. The one I shoot is the Boss 4 blade, and just a little tuning from my field points to this four blade broadhead, and I'm shooting darts, and I couldn't be any happier with it. It's durable, and the best part is it's made in America. So if you have yet to check out Wasp, go check out wasparchery.com. And if you do decide to purchase some broadheads, mechanical or fixed blade, please enter the discount code 9FINGERS. That's the number 9 followed by the word fingers, and you will save 20% off your order. Now, enough of all that stuff. Let's get into today's podcast where we talk about backcountry hunters and anglers with Rick Henley. All right, on the phone right now, Mr. Rick Henley. How you doing, man?
Good. How are you, Dan?
I'm doing pretty good. Now, this podcast is going to be about how Iowa is starting a backcountry hunters and anglers chapter. And we're going to get into all the meat and potatoes of that here shortly. But before, why don't you just tell everybody what part of Iowa you're from and what do you do for a living?
Right now I live in North Liberty, Iowa, just north of Iowa City. I've lived here for about 17 years now. I grew up not too far away from here, in a little town of Tipton. So I've always lived in Iowa. I've traveled all over the country, all over the world, but Iowa's always been home to me. So, and then as far as what I do for a living, I've been in the hunting firearms industry really since I've been in college. Now I work at the Rock Island Auction Company. We're the largest firearms auction house in the world. That's actually right over the river in Illinois. So I drive over there every day. But that's what I do on a day-to-day basis. I run our acquisitions department there, and basically it's my job to get in about 30,000 guns a year to sell at auction. So
gotcha. So what kind of guns do you acquire throughout the year?
Everything. I mean, really, I kind of say if it goes bang, we can sell it. We're really known for high end firearms. Just over 2 years, we've sold 3 guns over $1 million, which nobody else has ever sold. We've sold a single gun over $1 million. But then we'll sell 870 Expresses too. So, and everything in between.
Yeah. That's one thing I don't know anything about is firearms. Like, I could talk to you about archery forever, but when it comes to firearms, you just said something about that Express. I don't know what that is.
That's like the most common pump shotgun in America.
Okay, so I have one of those in my house. Okay, cool. So I'll tell you what, I'll take care of making myself look bad on my own podcast.
There you go.
All right. So
yeah, and I mean that's the thing with guns. There's so many idiosyncrasies of different guns that there's a lot to know out there on them. But
all right, so
we go see it all. So
I'm curious, who pays $1 million for a gun? Is this like General Lee's sidearm or some historic person's personal firearm?
Yeah, all those, pretty much had some history. I mean, they kind of have the they kind of have it all. They have, you know, rarity, condition, history behind them. The one that we set a world record with, we sold for $1.8 million. It was a Colt Civilian Walker, which was basically Samuel Colt's first revolver that he made as Colt. They only made approximately 100 of them. This thing's like still brand new. It was made in 1847. Still brand new. Still had the original factory case. Still had a signed letter from Samuel Colt in with it as well. So, you know, it had everything: condition, history, rarity. So
with something like that, how much research not only do you have to do, but do you have to, like, because I see these television shows where these guys hop in these vehicles and they go to, you know, farms throughout the United States and like, hey, can I take a look through your junk shed? And then they find some historical piece of, you know, like an antique or something that they're able to flip, right? Do you have to do any of that? Like, hey, a little bird told me that this person has a gun, but this person lives in South Dakota. You need to travel there. It's in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, like anything like that.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's a little different. So a lot of these are known already. You know, they've been discovered. I mean, there's certainly ones that we've discovered. Usually it's not like that. Usually it's somebody calling us and saying like, hey, I have this.
Yeah.
What is it? Or, you know, is it what I think it is? But yeah, I mean, there's certainly ones we've discovered that, you know, nobody knew they existed other than the person that owned them. And, you know, even they didn't really know what they had.
Right.
But other ones are, they've been known, they've been in books. You know, I mean, at one point they were discovered, you know, maybe it was 50, 60 years ago where they had that aha moment of this is what it is. But yeah, I mean, those are the ones that are exciting, are the ones where I come in on a Monday morning, I get an email and I say, hey, I've got this firearm. What is it? And, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe that just showed up in my email.
And it sucks.
And usually it's like, yeah, usually it's when can I come out and see it, you know? Yeah.
Right.
Does tomorrow work?
So do they, like, obviously at that point, you work for a very large company and I'm sure people do this all the time. Like, we're not just firearms, but in life in general, where it's like, ah, this is nothing. I'll give you $20 for it. And it's a $20,000 gun. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. you have to tell this person that, hey, your firearm is worth, you know, $15,000. I will buy it off you for 10 or whatever. And this, and then once they get that, then their whole demeanor probably changes and they're just like, I'm sitting on gold right now. Like, there's no way I'm going to sell it unless it's for, you know, $50,000. Then they get, and then the truth probably hurts sometimes, I bet.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, we don't do it where we're buying the stuff. We're putting it at an auction for them. So we're really on the same side as them. We want to get the most money for it. Cause that's how we get the most money. That's how they get the most money.
Yeah.
But yeah, you get that a lot of times where, sometimes I call that person up and I say, hey, this is worth X amount of money. And I think they're going to be super excited about it. And they think it was worth 10 times that much.
Right.
But we get the opposite where, you know, somebody offered me $2,000 for this and it's like, hey, this thing's worth $50,000 or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Those are exciting, obviously.
Absolutely.
When you get to give that person that news.
Well, it sounds like a fun job. Do you like your job?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it can be super exciting. I get jaded. I see the best stuff in the world when it comes to firearms. You know, I tell people all the time, I still remember I worked at Gander Mountain when I was a freshman in college. And I remember going in the first day of work, looking at a Benelli shotgun and thinking, who in the hell pays $1,000 for a gun, you know?
Right.
And now if it's not six figures, you know.
Yeah, that's crazy.
but I get excited about a lot of stuff. You know, it's the unique stuff that gets me excited.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily have to be the most expensive stuff anymore. So,
so cool. Now, when you say all guns that go bang, if I wanted to mount some like gun to my truck that went, brrr, could you like you, do you deal with those kind of guns too?
Yeah. I mean, we're a fully licensed machine gun dealer too. So yeah, we can't in Iowa. We can't own them in Iowa, but, there's a lot of states that can. So
yeah,
we sell them. We actually got coming up in our December auction, a Thompson that was there when Pretty Boy Floyd was shot by the FBI. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's good,
awesome.
Cool stuff.
So I could probably go down this rabbit hole for another hour or so, but we gotta stay focused because this is about backcountry hunters and anglers, and Iowa has is in the process of becoming an official chapter. So I went to one of the pint nights, and I was on some of the initial emails that were bouncing back and forth about, you know, basically the birth and the conception of this chapter. Why don't you share with us about maybe your personal experience, why you decided, first of all, why Iowa needed a chapter with on a state that is typically, you know, it's like 2% public ground, and then why you thought that you would be good for the co-chair, which you currently are.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I got started with it, I guess, just became a member, a couple of years ago. I heard about it through different channels. I've been on a Ducks Unlimited committee, here in the state for a few years now. And, you know, really, really enjoyed that. And, as I started getting into big game hunting, I kind of thought to myself, I want to find a conservation group that kind of focuses on big game. And as I got more into BHA, I thought that was kind of what I wanted to join. So I joined it, and then quickly thereafter, I thought, you know, there's not a state chapter in Iowa. There's state chapters in many, many different states across the country. There wasn't one in Iowa. So I said, you know what, I'll email them. And, if they ever decide to have one, I'd be more than happy to volunteer my time to help with it, to get it started. So I did that, emailed in, didn't hear anything for a while. And then all of a sudden, a big email chain came out that I think you were on as well, that just said, hey, we've had enough interest. We want to get one started. And we're going to put together a phone call where we can get everybody on there and kind of get the ball rolling.
Okay. Once that email came out to everybody, what was the next, you know, couple steps to, you know, from when BHA sent the email out, says, all right, you guys want it, here's what you have to do. What were the next steps after that?
So, yeah, on that initial phone call, there's about 30 of us on there. Basically, the first thing we did is kind of get together a board of directors. We all kind of talked about our own backgrounds. Why, just like what I'm just doing now, why I joined BHA, what I want to do for it. So we kind of went through that and just voted on everybody, as far as who was going to be on the board of directors. Some people on the phone calls, you know, they were just honest, said, I don't have the time to be on the board of directors. I just want to be able to help out.
Right.
I felt that I had the time. I thought it'd be really cool to just start something like that, you know, be a part of starting it. So that's why I volunteered to be one of the chairs. There's another gentleman, Frank Lake, that also said he wanted to be the chair. And he said, well, there's no reason we can't have two. You know, two good people working on it would be better than one. So we voted for that and got together our board of directors and started with that. And then from there, you know, we were set out with some goals. We had to have three BHA events. Which, you know, kind of the easiest and most popular ones to do are the pint nights, like you talked about, where we just, you know, everybody gets together at some sort of brewery or bar and you know, we have drinks together with a bunch of guys that like to hunt and fish, and we talk about it and get new signups. We sell some swag and raise some money. And we've had three of those. We had one in Ankeny. We had one in Coralville, the Iowa City area. And then we had one up in Sioux City. So we've already accomplished those. Then we also had to come up with three issues that we wanted to address as a chapter, specifically in the state of Iowa. So we've come up with those, and then we now have to write a letter of intent, basically, to the national board, stating that, you know, we want to become an official chapter. So that's kind of what we're working on right now to be hopefully accredited next month in December when the national board of directors meet.
Okay, cool. So this letter basically is just, here is, you know, we have this many people as members in Iowa. You know, we've completed all the tasks basically that you've asked us to complete. And here are the three issues that we want to accomplish, or we want to focus on moving forward as a official chapter, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So let's walk through these three issues. But before we do, how did you guys, because I didn't make that meeting. I wasn't able to make that meeting. How did you guys determine I'm sure everybody brought a whole bunch of ideas. So what were all these ideas, and how did you, I guess, boil it down to three main issues?
Yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of people had different ideas. I think the three issues that we ended up coming up with, you know, they kind of kept coming up. We also, you know, like I said, there's several people on that phone call, some of which, you know, said, we don't have the time to be on the board of directors. Some of them, you know, worked for basically state game agencies, said we can't be on your board. But, you know, they wanted to help out as well. And that's one of the things that the Iowa DNR, some of the guys that work for there and ladies that work for there have come to our pint nights, and we've had a chance to talk to some of these people, and they're very excited about us starting it. And they gave us a lot of these ideas as well of, hey, this is what we see as being the issues. So, I mean, kind of combined, like you said, we had a bunch of ideas. These ideas kind of kept coming up, between our, you know, our board of directors, different members that we had talked to, and then also the DNR. So it kind of was a no brainer when it came to these three, I thought.
Okay. And what are those three?
So the first one that we came up with was funding the Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust. And a lot of that is probably going to be through what's called the IWIL Coalition, the Iowa Water and Land Legacy Coalition. Okay. And basically what that trust is in 2010, all Iowans voted on this for a 3/8 of a cent sales tax that's going to go specifically to natural resources and outdoor recreation. 63% of the people voted for it in 2010. However, it was never funded. Okay. So it's on the books that, hey, we're supposed to have the sales tax, but they've never initiated the sales tax. Okay. As you can imagine, that's a lot of money that would go, you know, directly towards natural resources and outdoor recreation in Iowa, that if that were to get funded, I mean, that would help hunters and anglers throughout the state, plus a lot of other people.
Right. So, you know, you're talking second. About what, one second. I want to know, and I don't know if you've had conversations with, I guess, whoever was in charge of that yet, you know. So the Iowans voted for this tax. They approved it through votes, but the tax was never implemented. Why was that?
I mean, I'm sure it's politics, you know, even though people voted for it, you know, you start putting this tax in there. I think it was just a matter of people were afraid to do it because, you know, somebody'd be using it against them. But yeah, I mean, I can't really answer that as far as why. Gotcha. It never was funded. It just hasn't been, you know, and you go, like I said, on that, the I Will Coalition, and it's a group of a lot of different groups, you know, major conservation groups, farm groups, just business groups. So there's so many people that seem to be behind it, but they just, for whatever reason, they haven't funded it.
Right.
So
when the BHA now is getting involved, is that going to need to go to a vote again to re-implement it, or because it's been voted in previously, is it grandfathered in?
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to go to a vote, I don't believe, to the public. It shouldn't go to a vote to the public. I mean, at this point, it's a matter of just state government voting it in to implement the sales tax. Yeah.
So how much money are we talking about if this sales tax goes through for this organization or for this coalition?
Yeah, I don't have an exact amount, but I mean, so you're talking 0.3 cents sales tax on every dollar generated in the state of Iowa. So, I mean, you're talking millions and millions of dollars. They have a percentage breakdown of how that money has to be spent. And a large portion of that is just strictly wetland and wildlife restoration and protection.
Perfect.
Like 23% is the number just specifically geared towards that.
That's pretty cool. You know, that
there's
something out there and it's almost like a light switch. It's just waiting to be turned on. And yeah, when you hear the word taxes, I'm sure a lot of people get pissed off. I don't take money out of my paycheck and all this stuff, but it would probably, for the average individual, it would barely be noticeable.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't even notice. I mean, I'm sure a lot of hunters at this point don't realize they're paying the Pittman-Roberts Act as well on all their equipment. You don't notice it. And I mean, most people would be happy to pay that for the benefit that they're going to get.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's cool. And I just imagine what the state of Iowa will be able to do with those funds once that light switch does get turned on. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's more above and beyond, just specifically that.
Right.
You know, you've got water quality issues, lake restoration, trails, partnerships. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that people are going to benefit from. Not just hunters, but hunters and anglers are definitely going to benefit from it.
Yeah, and backcountry hunters and anglers, the name says it, hunters and anglers. However, for the organization as a whole, if you're not a hunter and you're not an angler, you will still benefit from the work this organization does. If you're just an outdoor enthusiast. So it's a win-win.
Absolutely.
It's a win-win. So, all right. So we kind of covered that first one. That's a big one. What's the next one on the list of three?
You talked about earlier, we have less than 2% of Iowa is public land. So just generally speaking, just not only protecting the public land that we have, the little bit of public land that we have, but also, more public land. It's something that, we probably have to look at down the future. Right now we're just starting out. We don't have a ton of money to throw around at some of these different projects, but, certainly in the future, I think that's something we would want to push for, the DNR has stuff in place to allow for cost share land acquisitions with different organizations. Obviously we'd love to be able to do that in the future. In the meantime, I think it's just about advocating for the public land that we have. Whether that's getting a group of guys to show up to some sort of public meeting where they're going to have a discussion about opening up public hunting to something else, or even, shutting down hunting in some certain areas. That's one of the things that got brought up where when we have a meeting like that, there might be, a bunch of anti-hunters that show up to it, but no hunters. So, that's the kind of thing that we can advocate for without having to do anything other than show up.
Right.
And that's the one thing that I've already found with BHA is, these guys are very, very passionate about it. If I said, hey, there's going to be a meeting at this town, at this time, I need as many guys as possible to show up and advocate for hunters. I know I could get guys there to show up and do that. So
that's awesome. So you said a term in there that I want to focus on a second. And that was something about something share land acquisition, cost share land acquisition. What is that specifically?
So, yeah, I mean, like I said, the DNR has a program in place as part of their, like, their open spaces protection. You know, the Iowa DNR has funds set aside to be able to acquire land for public use. But they also have, part of that can go towards, again, these cost shares. Okay, so maybe the DNR says they're gonna pay so much money to acquire this land, but they also need money coming in from these outside organizations. So, you know, different groups can put, basically solicit them to, let's put our money together. We're going to put so much money into this acquisition. DNR is going to put so much money into this acquisition. We buy this land, you know, it's willing seller, willing buyer. We buy this land, we put it out for public use. The DNR is going to manage that land then. So again, that's having people from outside of the DNR helping to acquire this stuff.
Awesome.
Acquire this more public land.
Yeah, that's cool. And that's something that, you know, you look out west and you have all these, you know, all these states, let's say like Wyoming, Idaho, Colorado, Montana, all these millions and millions of acres. And then you have Iowa, which a majority of it is all private. And like I said, 2% public. What kind of obstacles would you think we would run into? You know, is this something like, okay, we have money, now we need to go find land we need to buy? Or is this, hey, I talked to a guy, he's willing to sell his property for a fair market value just because he loves the outdoors and he wants to see his property turned into public hunting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's your biggest issue with that, is just finding those properties. You know, I mean, we all know too that land in Iowa is expensive. So that's obviously a huge thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're not going to be able to buy anything for $1,000, $2,000 an acre around here. You're going to be spending a ton of money for that. So finding the buyers, finding the sellers, you know, finding that money, and then putting it all together too. It's got to be, more than likely, it's got to be a big enough chunk of land to make it. To make it really worth it,
right?
As well, so
right.
But it's one of those things you just got to. I think you got to do it a little bit at a time and just put it together. I mean, don't get me wrong. We're never going to be able to have millions of acres in Iowa that's
right.
Public land. It's just it's never going to happen. We just kind of got to do what we can. So
right, that's right. Absolutely. All right. So try to get more public land and maintain the public land that we do have. What's the third one on this letter?
So the third one that we came up with is kind of commonly known as R3, and basically that stands for recruitment, retention, and reactivation of hunters and anglers. I think we all know that there's far fewer people hunting and fishing today than there was in the past. You know, when you're out hunting on public land, it seems like it's a good thing, but you know, it's a very small percentage of Iowans that hunt and fish, and you know, you have to have that influence. You have to have people, you have to have money, to be able to influence that, to keep our public land. You know, if nobody's hunting and fishing out there, or just a small portion of people are, it's going to be really hard for us to go to these meetings and say, no, we need to keep this land public and available for hunters, you know, when nobody's using it. So,
yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So how does this chapter plan on doing that? Has there been any talk about actually how to implement those three R's?
So, I mean, I think some of the different things you can do, I mean, I came into hunting kind of on my own. I didn't grow up in a family that hunted.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say they didn't hunt. They didn't hunt very much. My dad would go out on a pheasant hunt every few years with my uncle. And every once in a while I would go along and I just loved it. And just eventually I kind of got into it on my own, but, being in the business, I had kind of people that I could go to, but you know, if you're just trying to get into it, it's something pretty hard to get into by yourself.
Right.
There's a huge learning curve. So that's kind of the stuff that we've talked about is maybe like, you know, holding classes on, you know, how to butcher a deer or, you know, maybe it's how to read a you know, public lands map or, you know, Google Maps to figure out hunting spots, just how to find different public hunting land. So different things like that, just different seminars maybe that we can do to hopefully get more people out there interested in it.
Absolutely. So where does this start? Because when I think of new hunters, I used to think kids, right?
Yeah.
And as I start getting into this podcast more and start doing more things in the quote unquote in the industry, I'm finding that a lot of the people who are new to hunting are guys who run across, let's say, like the Joe Rogan podcast, and they see some popular figure, find hunting interesting, they like it, and now they're like, you know what, I think I want to give it a try. So obviously there's two different groups of people. You have an adult and then you have kids. Is there a focus on one that would maybe be easier or maybe a little bit more difficult, or is it kind of the same?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all part of the same thing. You know, I mean, I think it's easy to tell hunters to get their kids into hunting. You know, like I said, that's kind of always been the traditional way to do it. You know, why that hasn't necessarily stuck all the time, I don't know. But, you know, I don't know many hunters that don't try and get their kids at least, you know, access to it. I guess whether or not they end up doing it later in life is up to them. But, you know, most hunters I know are going to take their kids out hunting at some point. But I still think you got to focus on that. You got to get new people in it, no matter any way you can, I guess. But yeah, I think some of those, as far as getting adults into it, you know, that's where your different seminars I think are going to be more beneficial. You know, again, you're not gonna, the guy that hunts, he's not going to take his kid to one of those seminars. He's going to teach him himself,
right?
More than likely. So,
right, absolutely. So that kind of breaks down the three goals. Outside of that, is there anything else that this chapter plans on doing in the next 12 months, 2 years, 5 years, whatever, in order to, I guess, just continue to grow as a chapter and spread awareness for the organization?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously those are three things that we want to focus on as far as the benefit to hunters and anglers in Iowa. But, you know, also as a chapter, like I said, we want to get more people out there. And it's a bit of a social group, too. Those pint nights are awesome for that. Just, like I said, getting a bunch of group of hunters and anglers together to drink a beer and get to know each other. And that's a big reason as well why I joined, is I just wanted to meet new people that like to do what I do. So we'll definitely have more pint nights. You know, right now we're trying to get that letter in, kind of get through the end of this year. And then, you know, after the first of the year, we're absolutely going to have more pint nights in different parts of the state. You know, I know for sure we'll probably have one over in the Quad Cities and, you know, probably up in the northeast part of the state and just try and get around as much as we can to the different parts of the state. We're going to have a booth set up at the Iowa Deer Classic, doing a raffle there as well. Just trying to get, you know, generate money, generate interest, letting people know we're out there. Those are going to be the main things that we do. Just also talk of possibly getting together what we call a rendezvous. They have one at, for the national BHA every year in a different state, where it's just kind of a big get together. We're talking about maybe having one of those in Iowa next year as well, or just over the summer, where we can all get together for a weekend, camping, and I'm sure we'll find other events to kind of have there.
Cool.
But, makes it just more of a social event than anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, that's a big part of an organization is numbers, right? So the more time you can get I guess a group of people together, the more ideas, the more momentum that creates, you know, for the overall goals, that's nothing but a good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's, like I said, with these few pint nights that we've had, it's kind of surprising how many people we've had show up, and it's, you know, it's just, hey, this guy told me about it. You know, what's it all about? And you know, the more we can do that and just keep it snowballing, that's, That's how you get these things started, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, kind of going back to the very like the organization as a whole. If there's someone obviously not in Iowa listening to this, and they want to find out more information about backcountry hunters and anglers, what should they do?
So yeah, if you're talking just like the National has a great website, just backcountryhunters.org. You can go on there. They talk about, you know, kind of their overall mission and their overall issues. And I guess we haven't really talked about that on here, but that's the main things that they focus on as a national organization is public lands, you know, public land access and opportunity, and then just fair chase. Those are kind of their three main issues that you'll see on their website, but you can kind of go on there and learn more about that. And if you specifically want to kind of follow us as an Iowa chapter, you know, we have a Facebook page set up. You can just search under Iowa chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. We have a Instagram page, just BHA_IA. And we'll post any of our pint nights, any of our events that we're going to have on there. And, you know, we've been kind of trying to have some discussions on there to get people engaged, with some just different questions that have come up. You know, a while back we talked about landlock, public lands, just asking people for, hey, where do you know of any around the state? So we kind of got that conversation started. And
did we find any?
We did find a few, not as many as I thought we might, but we definitely found some. Yeah, it's really interesting to see that. And we asked the DNR guys about it, and they basically said at this point now they will not acquire any land unless it's, you know, accessible. But you know, from whenever these parts were or these pieces of land were purchased, they're just not accessible in any way by the public.
That's crazy. That's crazy. You think that's you would think that's a big Western issue, but because I know of one particular piece up in Northeast Iowa that I think it's like 80 acres or maybe 90 acres that's completely surrounded by private ground. So it's almost like that dude has an additional 90 acres he could do with it.
Yeah,
he can hunt by himself.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, that's kind of how it came about. You know, Onyx Mapping did a whole thing out west where they talked about the millions of acres out west that are inaccessible. And so, you know, we kind of wanted to figure out how much of that was in Iowa, and it's like you said, it's surprising there's any, but right. But there is.
Well, is there anything else that we need to share either about the Iowa chapter or the national chapter or the national organization?
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I just would encourage people to go kind of check it out. You know, I think it's a great organization. I think it's something that any hunters and anglers can get behind, whether you hunt on public land or not in Iowa, which, I, you know, most people that I know that hunt, they do at least a little bit. It's just a great organization for that we can, you know, keep what we have here in Iowa available to us. And then too, if you get guys that are, you know, dream about going out west, you know, obviously that's where this all started was out west, because like I said, they have way more public land than we have. It's very important for them to be advocates for it out there. So if you got guys that dream about that going out west, more than likely if you're going to go out west, you're going to be hunting on public land. And it's a great conservation organization for everybody. If like I said, even if you're not a hunter, the stuff that they're doing, the stuff that we're going to do is going to benefit anybody that likes to see, you know, wild animals and wild places. So.
Absolutely. Well, hey man, I really appreciate you taking your time to hop on the podcast today and then talk with us about this.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on and advocating for Iowa BHA.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. For more information, just go visit the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers website. If you are in a state, you don't know who to contact, if you go visit their website, it will show you whether or not your state has a chapter and then who you need to contact. So, and then social media as well. Huge shout out to Rick for coming on the podcast, man. Really appreciate him taking time out of his day. I know he's busy and I know he wanted to be in a tree, but instead he stayed out and did the podcast. Huge shout out to each and every one of you who has taken time out of your day to listen to these podcasts. Really appreciate that. Huge shout out to all the partners of this podcast: Exodus, Wasp, Lone Wolf, Deer Lab, Prime, Ripcord, Ozonics, Hunter Safety Systems. Also, if you haven't yet, you guys need to follow the Nine Finger Chronicles on Instagram and Facebook. There are days where I don't put the same thing on both social media platforms, so make sure that you're following me on both Instagram and Facebook. Also, go to iTunes or wherever you download the podcast and leave a review, not only for the Nine Finger Chronicles, but for all of the podcasts that are on the Sportsman's Nation podcast network. And other than that, I think we're good to go. There's still a lot of time in the rut, so if you're struggling, keep grinding. And this is the time of year where anything can happen, dude. Big deer are on their feet right now, and if they're not with a doe, they're looking for a doe. So the more time you can spend in the timber, the better. So keep grinding, and man, I'm rooting for each and every one of you. Last but not least, our friends with Hunter Safety Systems are reminding us to please wear your damn safety harness. Have a good week. Thank you.